Hello, and welcome to recording number 15 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. I'm going to start here on page 110, the first paragraph. Ord bent over and let his eyes play back and forth over the array, not touching any of them right away. While he was so occupied, Hangel scampered to the door, barred it and dropped its curtain, saying, "No sense in letting anyone bother you while you is choosing." Ord was ready to grab one of the weapons and defend himself against attack, but the dwarf merely came back to the counter and stared at the coins. When Gord hefted the first of the blades, it began to glow, and he nearly dropped it in surprise. His exclamation caused Hangel to shift his gaze away from the coins to see what was going on. "Der long-toothed one never did that, 'cause you ain't a demi-human," the dwarf said matter-of-factly. This short explanation completed, the dwarf returned to his loving contemplation of the money, and Gord resumed inspection of the daggers. He definitely did not like a weapon that shed light when it was drawn. Too much attention there, even though Gord could see advantages to such illumination at times. The second blade was of deep black metal, very sharp and deadly looking, but Gord noticed it had a few tiny pits in it. That one he replaced in its sheath, grateful for his keen eyes, and also set aside as undesirable. Of the three remaining, all but one glowed when held unsheathed. The last weapon he handled had beautiful balance, and it was almost as large as the one he had lost. Gord noted that its blade was covered with silver-inlaid runes, and his hand tingled slightly when he grasped the dagger and held it in fighting position. He tried a few passes with it, imagining an opponent before him. "Such an eye you have," Engel said. "You hold der best of my daggers." His deep brown eyes sad above the great brush of beard. Hangel stared solemnly at Gord and added, "It has de devomer, so dat it ignores armor und—" "What's a devimer?" interrupted Gord. "Magic, spells, and such," the dwarf said a bit crossly. "Don't be stupid." Hangel's accent was getting worse. Gord thought to himself. He meant Diomer, as in Diomer Crafter, a spellbinder. Norf must be losing his composure because of his fascination with the precious blade in Gord's hand. "Tell me more about this weapon," Gord said firmly. Hangel took it from him and unceremoniously hurled it at the stone floor. Much to Gord's amazement, the point went in, and the blade buried itself 2 or 3 inches deep. The dwarf broke into a faint smile as he beheld Gord's shocked expression, then said, "Stone, shield, whatever, their blade sees only like it as flesh. Of magic protections is another story, but demon or defil is leased mit easiness. You have just enough here to buy it, too." The dwarf was fast, but not as quick as his customer. As Hangel's hand darted for the treasure on the counter, Gord's small knife intercepted it, guarding the ring-crowned pile. "Not so fast, my friend," said Gord coolly. "I didn't say I wanted to buy it." He looked at the greed written across Hangel's face, shook his head, and continued, "No, at such a cost, I'm not interested at all." He scooped his treasure back into his purse, pulled the drawstring shut, and turned for the exit. "I shall look elsewhere. Goodbye," he concluded. Pardon me. Turning the page right here. Sorry about that. Just a little difficulty here. "Wait, stop," Hangel cried as Gord's hand started to unbar the door. "Perhaps I was too quick in counting their sum of your wealth." He thrust himself between customer and door, wringing his large, gnarly hands. Gord dangled his purse from his left hand, watching the dwarf's eye follow its motion. "Let us bargain further, then," he said, turning back to the counter. It took almost half an hour to come to a mutually acceptable price, and Gord was on the verge of walking out twice more before the dwarf finally yielded. Hagald had tried his best to get the cat's eye ring as part of the deal, but Gord had resisted, all the harder when the dwarf had reduced the number of gold orbs he also asked for in order to gain it. That made the young man very suspicious. The ring must have value beyond gold and gemstone, he thought. Eventually, Gord paid over 6 orbs, all the gold he possessed. The dwarf was not interested in platinum, although the plates were more valuable than gold orbs by a tenth. Hagel obviously cared much more about the yellow metal that his kind habitually favored. He was clutching the orbs fervently when Gord departed. Somehow Gord understood, for he was holding the haft of his new weapon tightly himself. It had cost him dearly to obtain it, and he would treasure it accordingly. Break. Well, there's several things right here. I'd say the last bit, the last bit about the gold. For one thing, 6 gold orbs, that doesn't seem likely, because Gord was supposed to have taken at least 30 on that last swindle he did, before going out again and then taking Sand's advice and leaving the city of Greyhawk. It seems that he's getting a magic dagger for 6 gold. I know that Gygax puts the value of gold very high. It also talks about, in that respect, that the dwarves in the campaign really seem to have a gold lust, where he's not interested in the more valuable platinum coins, but he's willing to let it go for 6 golden orbs. So I think here's a little discontinuity with how wealthy, how much gold Gord should have, with no mention of a loss of a large amount of gold, and also how valuable gold is in this campaign in and of itself, where we've mentioned that those gold orbs, that's enough to sustain somebody for a decade, somebody of middle class, of academia, like Prosper. And yet, at the same time, it does seem a little small amount, considering that one hand of the card game in the rich district netted Gord 30 gold and platinum. And it just seems unlikely to me that that's a bit of a discontinuity there.
Yeah, that now, seems pretty cheap.
Yes, I mean, after all that, Gord should have a lot more than 6 gold coins. And I was expecting it to be, you know, maybe 50 or 100 gold, some ridiculously large amount. It also goes to seem like silver, again, must not be that valuable when the Rene were talking. And, you know, when he got 25 silver from the youth to take Estrella, and where he was only going to have to lose 12 silver nobles if he wanted to, you know, renege. And so it is, there seems to be a little, and I know with writing, sometimes there are gaps between when you first write and from even into the next chapter. And with all the things that Gygax was doing, it really strikes me that, you know, at this point in time, he was still with TSR, he was busy doing a lot of stuff, and yet he wrote 2 full Greyhawk Gord novels during this time. And that, you know, this is 352-page book, so, you know, that's quite an undertaking. So possibly Gygax had a pause and didn't really have like a series of good notations to follow his own values of the coinage and stuff. We get a little more about how he saw that out, that ridiculous accent that he has, the dwarves going, something I would never play up in my campaign. I'm not good at accents myself, and I'm not really fond of silly voices, so trying to do this, the dwarf language accented common is a little difficult for me in the rereading, and I'd honestly prefer it not to be there, but I know a lot of people find that kind of thing spices up the game.
Yeah, it was hard to even understand. I mean, it was so unbroken at that one point where I posted a little bit.
Yes, and you know, what it is that even Gord mentions that the dwarf's accent is growing thicker. So that itself was something Gygax had planned to make the dwarven accent even thicker. So we have the dwarven blacksmith, you know, which is, you know, kind of a, you know, is iconic, and selling the magic daggers, the thick accent, and the lust for gold. Very, very much, you know, kind of fantasy, classical dwarven. We have, and if we look at things, we look again that we have descriptions of these various magical items here. Now, how Gord does not like the idea of a glowing dagger, which is kind of, I think, a little humorous poke at Tolkien, where you know, the sting and the two elven blades that they get from the Hobbit are all glowing blades. And here, Gord is thinking that he doesn't want anything like that. Then we get to the business of him describing. Now, I found it very interesting that one of the magic blades is damaged, or at least Gord thinks it's damaged. The black, sharp blade that has tiny pits on it. And it's something that isn't really discussed very much, is weapon and armor damage in the game. I've tried to run the AD&D campaign with it, and it becomes a little cumbersome to like assign hit points and damage to weapons and armor, and it is a bit of hand waving, even I do, and when I'm trying to run a campaign smoothly. But I've never really heard of a enchanted blade that is showing something like those pits. Now, I thought maybe it was something like a blade with poison, you know, like perhaps the pits are where poison could be placed on the blade, you know, like say a gummy poison, or maybe even a magical blade that would leak poison from those pits, or a rotting blade or something like that. But it does seem to me maybe an evil blade. It's a black metal blade. So that dagger that he mentions, that I found very interesting, that he mentions that it is a damaged-looking blade to Gord. And then we have Gord, the one he liked was beautifully balanced and large, with silver inlaid runes, and him actually feeling a tingle of the magic as he lifts it. And that's something that isn't... I don't see mentioned very often. I've seen a reaction to an intelligent blade, but to a just touching the magic, just touching the haft handle of the blade, I haven't heard it very much described before that you could feel the magic. So there are some interesting game ideas in here. A little bit about the setting, in the fact that you can, even in the Greyhawk campaign, Gygax saw that you could buy magic weapons. The final thing that strikes me is that the blade, the demi-human blade that Gord had used before, was even bigger than the blade he's using now or found. So either it was not a dagger, and it was more of a main weapon like a short sword, but it seemed to be a poignard, or else it belonged to a larger demi-human race, like as if it were a elven blade, because it seems strange that it would be a bigger blade for dwarves or halflings or gnomes, you know, who are, you know, half the size or close to half the size of a human.
Right, it was slightly bigger.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, it's little things like that. It's just little things you can really take off on, anything that gives you a little inspiration. And we could have, say, you could have a campaign, and I know right now on Cannon Fire there is coming up a post-fest about doing undersea things, and you could have someone discovering, like, Gord's poignard in the corpse of a slain sea monster, you know.
Nice.
You know, just checking, you know, in one of the undersea things, it could be one of the treasures to come across. And this is a gigantic, I mean, 100-foot-long sea monster. So it could be very well worth looking into. And I would say that if you have an exceptional monster such as that, then things like its bones and its teeth, perhaps its scales, because it had a resistant, you know, a scaly flesh that resisted the strike of one of the siege weapon scorpion crossbows. So I could see someone discovering it, or, you know, even a little fight going on between undersea creatures who are trying to scavenge that body of the sea monster. And it just strikes me that any little thing can really set you off into inspiration. And I found that little bit about the poignard. Obviously, in a regular campaign, it would be something much greater value than just 6 gold pieces.
For sure.
All right. And then finally, we have a mention again of the cat's eye ring. And, you know, which has popped up now, I'd say 4 or 5 times. It's been brought to the forward. And it's kind of like watching a TV show and some side character who's a recognizable actor appears. And you just know that it's not like a cameo, that this person's going to be linked to the storyline in that show or that movie. And I think there's a lot of foreshadowing of the cat's eye ring. It's been brought up so many times right now.
Yeah, and even Gord now is starting to think that there might be something more to it.
Yes, especially not just his natural reluctance, but now he can see that as much as the dwarf loved the thought of the gold, that he valued that ring even more, a value beyond gold and gemstone.
He didn't care about platinum. That was strange.
Yeah, that I thought was very, very unlikely. I would think, you know, because he could just turn the platinum over for gold.
Right.
I mean, it's a 10% greater value, you know, than the gold. So why couldn't he have accepted platinum and then just exchanged it for its value, or maybe even a little more value in gold? So I found that,
like, maybe it's like paint your wagon, where he had gold fever. I don't know.
I think, yes. No, I think that's exactly it. That the gold has a meaning for dwarves beyond its monetary value. That the possession of gold for a dwarf. And like I said, that's a very classical thing. I know Terry Pratchett, in his Discworld books, has all the dwarves in love with gold, and you know, that is one of their prime interests, is gathering gold and mining gold. So it is a classic theme that the dwarves would have that gold lust. All right. I am going to restart right here. It is page 112 and paragraph 5. He walked around the area for an hour or so thereafter, stopping in the meantime for some cold food and a flagon of ale at a local tavern, before returning to the marketplace. If anything, the market plaza was more crowded than it had been earlier. Gord was about to hurry through when his eye was caught by a swatch of the brightly colored, telltale garb of the Renee. Sure enough, there was Adaz, intent on her study of the wares of a goldsmith's booth. He was merely going to pass without speaking, for he was certain she wouldn't notice him, when her posture alerted him that she was doing something other than browsing. He glanced at the jeweler and the others nearby, sized up the situation, and moved quickly to the girl's side. "Don't bother with such inferior trash, Adez, my sweet." Gord smiled broadly as he said this, and took the girl's arm in his hand. The motion concealed his deft removal of the earring she had slipped into her sleeve. Adez looked up at him, startled, then angry. Before she could utter a word, though, Gord was speaking loudly again. "Let me see your selection, dear." He took her hand, and as if by magic, the purloined jewelry was there. "Just as I said, far too common and simple for someone so lovely." Gord tossed them to the startled owner, and the fellow barely caught them. Two other men who had been moving stealthily toward the Renee Lass also stopped short. "Now then, fellow, let's see something good. Don't bother with stuff fit for fat merchants' wives," Gord commanded. The goldsmith was taken aback. He countered quickly. "You don't have enough," he started, then caught himself and reworded his objection. "You didn't say what sum you'd pay. How can I select without knowing the depth of your purse?" Gord ignored the impertinence. He pointed imperiously at a pair of small but brilliant rubies, enmeshed in fine golden wire. "Those, Smith, are more to our taste. Fetch them." The man brought them to Gord as commanded, but while so doing he jerked his head toward the pair of stalwarts who served as his guards, and they moved to either side of Gord and Adez. The girl had finally caught the drift of what was going on. She moved closer to Gord and smiled wanly at him. Her olive skin appeared pale. Without seeming to notice the guards nearby, Gord carefully examined the earrings, allowing the slanting afternoon sunlight to play upon the sparkling facets of the gems, the rays turning them to fiery blazes of crimson. "They are acceptable, but worth no more than a plate," he said, as he stared at the proprietor of the booth, face set, eyes narrowed. "A plate, ha, a plate each, I say. Do you think me a dolt or an idiot?" the fellow shouted back. The haggling began. Gord agreed too quickly to a price of 2 orbs, handed over 2 lozenges of platinum, received a pair of luckies in return, and still holding Adez by her shapely arm, strode away. She said nothing, for she knew that Gord had saved her from being arrested for theft, but that he was furious over what the rescue had cost him. When she ran her free hand over his bicep, Gord did not respond. Break. Well, I'm always interested in coinage. So we have here that the cost was 2 orbs, and Gord hands over 2 platinums and gets 2 luckies in change. So now we know the value of an electrum piece is 1/10 of a gold piece. So you can imagine that the silver noble is a fraction thereof. So, you know, right away, we can again see the value of gold. And yet, then we see now the value of gems, where what have to be fairly small rubies, as their earrings, they are now worth, quite a considerable amount of money right there. Gord pays 6 golden orbs for a magic dagger, and he pays 2 golden orbs for a set of earrings. So, again, this could be that Gord has overpaid, or it could be that the value of gems is very high up in the way that Gygax has the setting. That's actually a very handy thing, in a sense, where if you have a large amount of treasure, either taking gems or turning them in for gems would make it a way for you able to hide or carry a much larger value than you could ever do with coins. I again find that a little off balance, though. I think a known magic weapon should be going for, even with this crazy gold value, it should be going for a lot more. I really did like working out the price of the Electrum. I don't know if we'd done that before, but that it goes, you know, the price increase, you know, the value is that 10 Electrums are worth one gold piece. And we really don't get, other than the bronze Zs, we haven't really worked out or been told the value of one coinage versus another coinage.
So it seems like a plate is equal an orb and a lucky.
Yes. So okay. We know that the plate is 10% more than an orb, so the value of the lucky then is 10% of a gold. So,
oh, there you go.
Yeah. You know, so we've got 10 electrums for every gold piece. I'd like to find out what he values, and maybe looking it over again, there's a way to work that out, but I don't think so yet. I'd really like to work out what the value is of a
silver piece.
Of a silver piece. Now, we haven't heard the value of a copper, and in comparison, we know that the next thing down is the bronze Z. The bronze Z is worth 1,000 bronze Zs to the gold, so it's going to be 100 bronze Zs to the electrum piece. And so the copper common and the silver noble are somewhere between there. And the way things work, it should be a tenth or a, you know, some kind of value. But it does put the bronze Z pretty close to the copper common. And that's entirely possible. It, you know, it doesn't, those are strange, the iron drab, the brass bit, and the bronze Z. They are odd coinage. You know, it's only so far that I know in this Gygax novel that has them mentioned as a valuable, you know, as a coin that really can buy you stuff. I mean, it, you know, it bought Gord a year's education for only, you know, like 365, not even, because it was 6 days a week. So, you know, it brought Gord a year's worth of sage tutoring and education from Prosper for, you know, the cost of about a third of a gold piece. And so it'd be very interesting to know the value of nobles and commons. It's not necessarily, you know, a straight, geometric progression, because, you know, the original, if you look at the English coinage, you know, before they went metric, their coin values were this variation. You know, it was, you know, so many, you know, pence and shillings and farthings and half pence. And, you know, so their coinage was very much not a straight 10 by 10 by 10 kind of thing. You know, a dime, a dollar, you know. So it is possible here that that the coins, you know, you could have, like, say, 25... coppers to the silver, you know, it could be something like that, but we still don't have that. We do get a look here of, you know, how the René are. It might just be a Daz, but I would assume that the René, known very much as thieves, then the young women are also, you know, trained as thieves as well as the men. So I'd kind of think the René men are kind of fighter thieves, or maybe just warriors and thieves and warriors. And the women, when they're young, start out as thieves, and then at some point they become sages with divination and witches and, you know, a little clerical ability. So the women actually have, I think, more variation than the René men. And mostly it seems like the René men are just direct either thieves, warrior thieves, or warriors. And, of course, sailors. You know, I mean, something above somebody familiar with the water to somebody who lives on the water most of the time. All right. I am going to restart. It is page 114, chapter 12, paragraph 1. Radagast City was larger than Lukesh, smaller than Greyhawk. Gord's family came to the principal place of County Ernst, along with a veritable fleet of barges, having sailed from Lukesh with seven or eight, and then having met and been joined by many others. The convoy was for protection against the pirates, who were known to ply the near Dev between Lukash and Radagast City. And besides, the barge folk didn't have to worry about antagonizing anyone with this apparent show of force. Countess of Ernst, who held sway over this principality, had no particular dislike of the René, as did Duke Carol, her cousin, who ruled Duchy Ernst. From what Gord could determine, the barge folk often received fees from her noble brilliancy for spying, intelligence, or actual services of a more military nature. Gord wasn't exactly sure of all that, for nobody spoke directly to the matter, and his questions were never answered. All right. A little more about the René. Quite a bit right there, learning that the René, that their animosity and fighting even with the Duke and the Duchy, but that the county, ruled by their countess, it actually makes use of the René as, kind of an auxiliary military force, as spies, and again, adding, if you're going to run a René campaign, this is all, really good meat for adventuring ideas and what you can do. It also mentions that there are pirates plying the coast between Lukash and Radagast City. So here we have, more reason for the René to be more of a skilled fighter group than simply just merchant sailors. And traveling in force, and again, more information about the René and ideas for a René campaign, and an idea of how the coast and the waters along the near Dev are, that there is not a naval patrol or something that has driven the pirates from the coastline. And you have to ask, too, where would these pirates be based? Are there, Duchy of Ernst pirates raiding County of Ernst people? I mean, it's also interesting to know that the Duke and the Duke and the Countess are related, that they're cousins. So right there in that first paragraph, we've got a little bit, Radagast City, larger than Lukash, smaller than Greyhawk. Really doesn't pin things down, but still, it gives you a good idea. The business about the pirates, the attitude about the René, and also how they like to travel in a big group, and how big that group would be, because it starts at 7 or 8, and then many more join, so you're probably looking maybe 20 or 30 of these barges traveling together in a little flotilla.
It also says a lot about the importance of the near Div, as both the capitals of the Duchy of Ernst and the County of Ernst are on the near Div.
Yes, and how much the, I would say that the more you get away from the immediate area around the city, or unless you're in a very well-established nation, then it's probably safer to do your merchant trading along the coast, even with the risk of pirates, than it would be to going across the wilderness in between. I don't know how Gygax saw the Ernst, the Duchy and the County of Ernst, as far as how dangerous it would be to be going through the wilds. But I just would think that knowing how adventure, how much adventure is part of the idea of the Greyhawk campaign, that it would probably be safer and more reliable to have something like the René sailing up and down the coast. And that even though the Duke and the Duchy of Ernst does not like the René, they seem that they're important enough that he puts up with them.
Right. At worst, they're a necessary evil.
Yes, and I think that may be one of the big things. I wonder how Gygax saw the river merchants and the merchants across the near Dev. I just tend to think that the René stand out. They're so featured in the story so far, and they seem to be, here they're a large enough group where they're not worried about the Duke, and they were able to fight kind of a fight to the standstill against the Duchy of Ernst. So that really speaks that there are probably a very good number of René, and that they're all of them are skilled, you know, in the use of certain weapons, or they may even be leveled fighters or leveled thieves, and so a much stronger force than, say, your normal kind of zero-level guardsmen that you see in, you know, in a lot of the cities, or even first level. So as the campaign goes, it's really, it is painting a picture here with little clues of the kind of setting that Gygax envisioned, with lots of opportunity for adventure right here. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 114, paragraph 2. When the flotilla of barges came to a place near the capital city, they went up a small river mouth, a branch of the Artansame's great delta, to Mudditch, a large village of some 800 or 900 souls. The visiting René always made a point of basing themselves at Mudditch and traveling overland to Radagast City, which was only a bit more than a league distant. Perhaps that explained part of the relative friendliness for them that the county Ernstmen evidenced. Before they had taken leave of Lukash, Adaz had been most attentive to Gord. He wasn't certain if the attention was born of gratitude, or the fact that she wanted the ruby earrings which he had kept, but whichever it was, he didn't care. Despite all her overtures, Gord was only coolly polite. He had experienced all he'd ever wanted of René womenfolk with Estrella. When they put into Mudditch, Adez tried again to win him over, but Gord managed to slip quickly away. All right, now that's break right here, and that is very interesting. Now, now we're seeing on the map here, there's the Artansame. No mention here of the little Mudditch.
Mudditch? Yeah, I didn't see that.
I think that's just a Gordism. You know, I see Stoink up there on the map on the Artansame. And there we have the Rift Canyon, but with the size of these hexes.
30 miles, I think.
Yeah, you know, I think it is like 30 miles a hex across. So that is quite a distance, and the Artansame is quite large. And, you know, if you look at the near dev right there, look how wide that is. That's, you know, easily 90 to 120 miles across there.
Yeah, I thought it was about 150 miles from Lukash to Radagast City.
Yeah. Now, I find it interesting that Gygax shifts them from going right into Radagast City with their barges to stopping at Mudditch. Because then, now they're bargemen. They're bringing all their goods and they're taking all their orders. So they have to, even though it's maybe a safe route, it doesn't seem that it would be safer than taking the barges in. And also, how are they going to transfer their goods? I mean, Mudditch then would probably have a lot of teamsters and wagons, all in wait of these René coming and goings, because they would have to shift all their things and then get away from their barges. I mean, they'd really kind of have to split their group, because they'd need one group to stay at Mudditch and then the other group to take the goods and probably trade goods and buy goods, do an exchange, all the way to Radagast City. So
it looks like the near div's a little deeper at Radagast City than it was at Lukash. So maybe there's monsters, or I'm just guessing from the map. But
it is very strange. I mean, we do see those contour lines, and that the center of the near dev is the deepest part. Mm-hmm. So we'd guess that when they were driven astray by the storm, that they went off into that deep blue water.
I think they went 10 leagues out, so it was about, well, I mean, a league, hexes. Who knows what a league is, but about 30 miles at least.
No, a league, I thought a league was 3 miles.
Yeah, when I looked it up, it said like anywhere from 2.8 to 4.6 miles. It depends on who you talk to, so it's an arbitrary measure.
Yeah. So, oh, and these are 30 miles or 30 leagues across are the hexes.
30 miles.
Okay, that's much better. 30 leagues would be considerable then. Yeah. Now Lukesh is to the west then, isn't it?
Of Greyhawk.
Of Radagast City. The Duchy of Ernst would be west of the county of Ernst. And, you know, very quick to see if I had my map open or something.
Yeah, but mostly it is.
So it is very interesting, this little bit there, that even the Countess is pleased. That just seems very strange to me, and a kind of a strange comment. But again, it emphasizes that Gord really doesn't know. You know, he asks questions, they're not answering them. So even though he's adopted into the Rene, he's obviously still an outsider. You know, he's not really part of their family, not yet. Because he's ignorant of a lot of the customs, which got him into trouble. And, you know, obviously they bet against him. Mm-hmm. There's so many. And then here, right where he's asking them questions, and they're not giving him answers.
Right.
That is interesting that there's a small river mouth, but it's supposed to be a branch of the Artansme. So that opening down there we see is not just a normal river opening, it's a delta. So it's going to be maybe a main stream and lots of smaller streams that lead up, into that very easterly, northeasterly river there. And also it can tell you that, boy, you could take a barge right up to the edge of the Rift Canyon if you were going to do, White Plume Mountain. It's right up there, probably with villages and towns all the way along that riverbank.
Doesn't look like it's rocky or there's too many rapids, so looks like a fairly substantial river.
Then at the end of it, you have Stoink, which was supposed to be a developed area. I noticed that the person who did the review recently, he really disliked the idea of a place called Stoink.
To let him make his own world up, huh?
I just found that was ridiculous.
Yeah, I think so too.
All right.
Some guy is acting like he's woke or something.
I know. It was very unfortunate. I do understand a little more, though, because I think the writing's better than I remembered it, but at the same time, it is a very gritty, much mm-hmm. more grim City of Greyhawk than I had really remembered it being expressed as. I don't know if it just didn't strike me as such when I was younger, but it really seemed to be a very rough place, city, it's the big city, and it's got all kinds of people, and we are looking at it from a thieves' point of view. That whole saga of Old City is the eye view of a thief, and which kind of goes in with the Fairford and Mauser from Lieber, is that the pair of them, although they were warriors, they were also thieves. And, Mauser is a magician thief, and Fafrid is a warrior thief, and a bard. So it's very much in keeping with Lieber's Lankmar. I think that was a big inspiration for Gygax. But, I can understand why some of the stuff must be shocking. Shocking point of view that you're... People can't, I think, even really imagine of trying to do something that isn't like very blatantly, like very painted on kind of what's right and what's wrong, and instead do something where there are, shades of in the characteristics of people, and that there are different cultures, And obviously, the Rene have a very strange culture, but it is not something historically that stands out as something far-fetched. It is a very rough culture, a very deadly one, if you consider that on Miklos's barge, three of the men were killed in that one encounter. And you have to wonder, where is he going to get replacements for them, except from the young, you know? All right. We also have here where, again, Gord is now maybe learning a little more here about women, because instead of letting Adaz, get close to him, Gord is avoiding her, and he's using his anger over at having to rescue her and costing him money. It didn't really cost him anything unless he overpaid for the earrings, which is possible. But Gord still has the ruby earrings, so I don't think he's lost that much. He's just not going to be taken from that truly, large amount of coin, 2 gold pieces, for just because he's interested in Adaz.
Yeah, he finally learned his lesson.
Yes, and and that is something there where, it's a simple way, but they are trying to show that Gord is growing. He grew quite a bit quickly, as from the workhouse orphan to becoming the beggar thief and part of the elite, and he grew that way very quickly. But every encounter with women up until now hasn't played really well into Gord's into a positive for Gord, and here he's become a little more cautious. How he doesn't want to acquire Adaz as he did Estrella. He doesn't want to lose out to Adaz. And he had already shown that with that Trilene, where he robbed her and
Sunray
before leaving them. All right. I'm going to restart.
Left him 2 luckies, I think. He left him 2 luckies.
That was it. 2 luckies. Which... that would be enough for them to stay not in the high quarter, but they could go back to the craftsmen's, and they could probably live for a good long time on the 2 luckies. And they are both experienced thieves, but it was a nasty little thing to do, and not parting as friends, certainly, because Gord had managed to hide his own treasure that he had put away, but he also stole theirs.
I bet they had reserves, too.
Quite possibly. I mean, it seems that, like, even San,
right?
If you remember, San, while he wasn't able to hide up in the rafters and backstab and successfully fight off that assassin, he was able to hear what was going on, figure out what was going on, and run away.
Right.
And I don't think there was tremendous gain for Gord. I'm trying to think. I mean, he didn't take the armor. I'm pretty sure
the group treasure, right? So he would have taken all the winnings from that game.
Yes, and that was said to be 30 gold pieces. Right. And platinums, the total value, that was 30 gold. And you could work it out to a certain extent from the betting. But really, what's happened to it? If the bulk of his gold coins are only 6 gold... That just seemed very strange to me.
Yeah, where did the money go?
I mean, it's possible if they had robbed him when he was unconscious, that would have been mentioned. And Miklos,
yeah, he would have noticed and been enraged.
And Miklos doesn't even, he mentions that they've used up their wealth, but he's just going to take the 25 silver nobles from Gord. And and then Gord stayed with them. I hadn't quite remembered that. I thought he had run away from them at that point, rather than give in those nobles. But obviously, there's no mention of it, and he stays with them longer up until he reaches Radagast City, so that Gord probably just handed over those silver nobles to Miklos. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 115. Paragraph 2. For the next several days, Gord explored Radagast, met and talked with its citizens, and covertly watched the less savory elements of the city at work and play. He would have engaged in some amusements and contributed to the city's economy, but the fact was he was just about broke. The purchase of his dagger and the earrings, plus the orb he had grudgingly handed over to Miklos, left him with only about 4 plates to his name. better off than most, and he realized that. But these days, unless Gord had more than a dozen plates in his purse, he considered himself strapped. Then an idea struck him, and he hurried back to the village where his family had set up camp. Break. All right, well, that kind of answers things. I again think that Gord seems to have less money than he should. Now he's handed over a gold orb to Miklos, and that you know, kind of answers things about the questions there. But it still seems like...
Does that mean 25 silver nobles equals an orb?
No, not necessarily.
Okay. I
think that the 25 silver nobles, that was in Lukesh, and now Gord has also handed over an orb. Unless we're wrong, but it doesn't seem possible, because I'm pretty sure it goes silver then electrum. Maybe it goes electrum then silver, but it just seems like they're tossing around silver quite a bit
silver, electrum, gold.
Yeah, because that would mean that the silver is worth 2.5 times the value of an electrum. And that doesn't seem to be the breakdown. The lucky seems to be between a silver noble and a golden orb.
Yeah.
Now we have, what else was there right here? We have a little bit more about Gord's change in values. That if he doesn't have a dozen platinum plates, he doesn't think he thinks he's going broke. And he has 4 plates, so that is, equal to, 4.4 gold pieces. And that's just, he bought the dagger for 6 gold. It's just, it seems to me that Gygax is pushing, from Gord's sense, the value of gold and platinum is down to the point where Gord starts off with 2 iron drabs, which would only buy him like an evening's meal in the slum quarter. But now he's at the point where he's got 4 platinums. And that was kind of talked about when San and Gord had robbed, taken Theobald's purse or his money had set aside. Not the coins that had in the box that had hit Theobald, but they left those behind. But just the money that was in the escape room where there was costumes and various things. And they thought that the plates, there might have only been like 4 plates there, and they thought they were immensely wealthy.
Yeah, so, at that point in time, they had never even seen platinum.
That's right. And here, Gord doesn't think he is has enough money unless he has got 12 platinum pieces.
Right.
That has always been symptomatic of an AD&D adventure game is the monetary creep. Is that, as they're successful adventurers, and because it's not, you don't have the normal things to spend it on. You really only spend on particular items and maybe checking off things as upkeep. But normally, once an adventurer is semi-successful and mid-level, they are now incredibly wealthy, compared to, like the first level. And even there, of course, we have in AD&D some of these first-level people with hundreds of gold coins to start with. And that's, obviously it doesn't equate to Gygax's Gord campaign. Those values just don't, jive together. And even at the value that Gygax is putting on gold, I do not think that 6 gold pieces for 6 gold orbs for a magic dagger is... That just seems ridiculously, low valued for a magic weapon, especially one that ignores armor. Armor is like flesh, and if you go into combat and your dagger negates any non-magical armor, and or even stone, that is, that is a tremendous, tremendous weapon there. All right, we have a little bit of time, so I'm going to restart here. It is page 115, paragraph 3. Gord found Adez at the edge of the village commons, watching a caravan of covered wains setting up there. When he asked her what was going on, her pretty face contorted into a scowl, and she spat. These dogs in the wagons claim to be Rene too, but they are Atloy, half-breed nothings, vagabonds, liars, and chicken stealers. Filing that away for future reference, Gord smiled and invited her to come with him for some fun in the city. They could leave early tomorrow and make a day of it, seeing what there was, eating, drinking, and who know what. Well, that is very interesting. I hadn't read before that the Rene and the Atloy were not on friendly terms. Also, I wanted to mention that, again, we have the idea that over at that Mudditch, there is a encampment of the Rene, you know, and that's where their barges would be, because they sailed up the Artonsme in their barges to get there. So I don't know if it means that they have gotten, you know, left the barges and set up a camp on the land, or whether their barges are their encampment, like they were in the city of Greyhawk. And then, when I like Gord files this information away, here's the first mention of the Atloy, who are the, you know, they have their caravans and wains, and they are like the classical, you know, European gypsy, not going on barges, but going by wagons. And here we have, at least at Daz feels, that they are half-breeds, vagabonds, liars, and kind of beneath her contempt. I think at this point, it is just about 7, so I'm going to stop a little short here. Money, start. Yes. Now, if we look at AD&D, we have a potential of a fighter starting with 200 gold pieces and a cleric with 180, and even a monk 5 to 20 gold pieces. And we have to really reduce... in the Gord campaign, really reduce those, the value, well, increase actually the value of gold. And that I would say, you know, the starting values, those might be prices in electrums. You know, I think you'd only get a fraction of this value in gold in Gygax's ping. Because you
would be super rich if you had that starting gold like that in Greyhawk, in Gary's Greyhawk.
Yeah, if we go back to Prosper, because he's the one we know of what he's earning. He works a whole year and only is teaching Gordon Sand. So he is getting 2 gold, you know, not even 2. He's getting like 2/3 of a gold piece and his food 6 days a week for the meals. But that's all he is getting for a year. And here we have somebody who's this fighter who could, from 50 gold to 200 gold. So, you know, we really have to look at reducing the value, increasing the value of gold substantially, and reducing what kind of starting coins that these first level characters would have. And they, you know, they would be talking bronzes or copper commons or silver nobles, I think. And I don't think they'd... Any of these things and the basic equipment and supply costs, those values would have to be reduced because of the buying power of gold. So, you know, if some fighter starts with as a first level fighter, starts with 200 gold pieces, I mean, that is just a ridiculous, I mean, that's almost 2 centuries of living expenses, right. More than 2 centuries right. Of living, centuries. So, you know, the value of these things has is so much more than the Gygax campaign. And I've seen people, they've commented that they don't quite like how this, you know, gold has been put up and is so valuable. But I have to say, I think that is a better way to start. Start down as low as you can. And then at the point when the characters are becoming mid and high level, where they're going to be rich... And then they can act like, you know, knights and ladies and powerful magic users and accomplished thieves and, you know, powerful clerics, and that they're also going to have the coin to go with it. And I think that it's much better to start with rarity of magic items and a lower value of coin And then the other thing is that the relation between coin and experience points in the AD&D game is it's off-putting for me. It's not something I'm fond of.
Yeah, you'd have to play with the numbers if you wanted to run a campaign in this world.
Yes, and I would like to run. I run my own kind of Greco, but it's very Gygaxian, and I think that this. I really like the high value of gold, I like that there's all this different coinage and stuff that is out there. So far, I really like what Gygax did with the monetary system. I think there's an inconsistency here, but at the same time, that is easy enough, I think, to you know, rough out your own value system for certain items. But I do like the fact that gold has tremendous buying power. All right, we're at 7 o'clock. I'm afraid I've got to run tonight, so.
Yeah, me too.
All right, I'm going to set this up to end the recording. I believe all the previous episodes, all the previous recordings are on the archive on Cannon Fire website. And so if you want, we've got, I believe, you know, that's 14 hours so far. And this is our 15th recording. So 15 hours once this is put up. And honestly, I really feel that you can start anywhere with these things. Jump back if you want, re-listen. If there's so much of this that is commentary that I think a lot of it is going to be worth listening to several times if you like what is being said and you like that section that is being described. All right, well, that is it for recording number 15.